Ascent Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Touch of the Madness, How to Be More Innovative in Work and Life by Being a Little Crazy, by Lawrence Kazanoff. Narrated by Lawrence Kazanoff. For All the Great Scoundrels. Chapter 1. Welcome to the Madness. I wanted to be a movie producer since I was a little kid. And I got lucky and became head of production of an independent film studio called Vestron when I was right out of grad school. By the way, I thought I nailed getting this job because I was such hot stuff, having just graduated with my MBA from Wharton. That lasted about 5 minutes, until my boss, in his welcoming speech my first day, said, "By the way, if you pull any of that business school crap, you're fired." So much for the Ivy League in Hollywood. Okay, back to the story. Vestron rode the boom in home video, which at the time was relatively new and exploding. We were sort of the Netflix of the day. I had to deliver 80 movies a year. Buy them, produce them, co-finance them, doesn't matter, said my boss, but 80 movies a year and don't lose money on any of them. So mostly we made action movies, comedies, horror films, and fun commercial stuff. Then along came this movie called Platoon, and I wanted to make it. This was not at all our kind of film. The people in it became stars, but most weren't stars at the time. The director, Oliver Stone, had done one prior movie which we co-financed, and while I thought it was brilliant, it didn't do much business. Platoon wasn't a catchy title. It dealt with the extraordinarily serious topic of the Vietnam War and how it affected the kids who went. The tagline was, "The first casualty of war is innocence." It was not the kind of movie we were making. To his incredible credit, my boss, Austin First, who was a talented, disruptive entrepreneur, said, "Okay, you're the head of production. If you want to do it, you can do it." But there was a but. "You have to bet your job," he warned. "If it fails, you're fired." He wasn't bluffing. He fired people all the time. "What do you want to do?" I took the shot. Much later, I saw the movie one early morning at a film festival in Italy right after it had been finished. I am probably the only person in the world who giggled their entire way through Platoon, not because it wasn't amazing, but because the whole time I was thinking, "Oh, thank God, I'm not getting fired." Platoon went on to win Best Picture that year at the Academy Awards. A few months later, I ran into Oliver Stone, the director, at a bar in New York City. "You know, kid," he said, "I always liked you. You have a touch of the madness." "A touch of the madness?" I thought. "Is he saying I am a bit crazy? Was I crazy?" I had to think about that. Then I realized my boss encouraged the touch of the madness by letting a 25-year-old run a huge production slate and take a risk on a movie no one else would touch. I had a touch of the madness by betting a once-in-a-lifetime job to do it. The director had a touch of the madness by never giving up his battle to make a Vietnam movie in a way no one ever had. The whole innovation that was Platoon would not have happened without a touch of the madness. I realized I loved that phrase. It hit me. Innovation demands a touch of the madness. First, why does everyone talk about innovation? Why is it so important? The current of the river of life will always try and pull you towards the middle, towards complacency and mediocrity. This is true for every person and every company. It's a problem because other companies that don't give in to that current will eclipse you. Companies and organizations tend to be comfortable with the tried and the true. But the audience, in other words, your customers, are attracted to what's new, different, and better. The best tool you have for swimming against that current of mediocrity is innovation. To grow and become a great company, a great entrepreneur, you must actively embrace it. You can become pretty good without it, but not great. You must take a shot. And to be very innovative, you have to be a bit crazy. You need a touch of the madness. That's what I foster in myself, in my company, and in my movies. It's what companies have to cultivate in their culture, their employees. You can't be great without it. And it doesn't mean to just be a little crazy in what you think up. It also means you must have a mad enthusiasm, a crazy sense of purpose and devotion and perseverance, a touch of the madness in how you create it, implement it, and make it thrive. How to do it? 3 steps. Create. Find the essence. Ask anybody, anywhere, for anything you want. Play it all like a game. Chapter 2. Create. First, create a great idea with a touch of the madness. Simple, right? A touch of the madness gives you some guidelines for how to be more creative and innovative. They are: find the essence of your idea. Know your target customer or audience. Let technology serve your idea, not the other way around. Once you've created your idea, never let go. And do it all with a mad fire in your belly, never give up mindset. Here's the breakdown of the four steps. Essence of an idea. When I decided to make Mortal Kombat into a movie, everyone told me I was crazy and my career would be over. You can't make video games into movies. And every prior attempt had failed. It had never been done successfully at that point. The secret to Mortal Kombat. But here is a secret. I never thought I was making a video game into a movie. I thought I was making the essence of that video game, the thing that made it so successful, into a movie. Think of a game or intellectual property as a pyramid. The game to me was not the apex of the intellectual property pyramid. It was one rung down. The apex is the magic pixie dust that made Mortal Kombat such a great video game. I've always thought with Mortal Kombat, it was empowerment. Wrapped in a visually stunning package, of course, but empowerment nevertheless. Martial arts teaches that you don't have to be the biggest and the strongest to win if you focus, study, and do the right thing. And the game really reinforces that. When wandering around an old-fashioned arcade, this was a place in the old days where you went to play games that were in freestanding big console machines, trying to decide if I should bet my career on Mortal Kombat, an 11-year-old kid slapped a quarter down on the arcade game, looked up at me, and said, "I challenge you to Mortal Kombat." Then he beat the hell out of me, and the game egged him on, saying things in that great, deep, resonant Mortal Kombat like, "Sub-Zero wins. Flawless victory. You lose." The kid left feeling great. I decided then and there to go for it. Now, once you have that essence, that top view, you can decide where to sprinkle it. Recently, I was executive producer of a hit Mortal Kombat movie. It was my 19th Mortal Kombat production in 20-something years. I have produced it in every medium in the world. The franchise has grossed almost $10 billion. Here's another one. Several years ago, I went to LEGO to try and get the rights to make a full-length animated film. LEGO had not done that before. They were concerned that if it didn't work, it might embarrass them. So we all decided to make a movie that would go straight to DVD. If it hit, great, and we could go make a bigger one next. If it failed, it would be under the radar and no one would really notice. I raised independent money to make the movie and set a deal with Universal to distribute it. Now, what is the essence of LEGO? This one was easy for us because LEGO knew. The essence was, we build on each other. LEGO, when the characters came to life, was not just about blocks and bricks or kids playing. It was about teamwork and counting on each other and, well, building on each other. We put that into the first full-length LEGO feature film, LEGO, The Adventures of Clutch Powers. It was a DVD hit. We wound up doing LEGO Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Out, LEGO theme park rides, and more, all with that essence infused into it. In my opinion, LEGO's success is not a fluke. They know their essence. Know the essence of your idea. What makes it so appealing and great? Okay. Next step to creating great ideas? Audience. Who do you work for? Your boss? Your foreman? Your editor? Your board? No. You work for your audience, for your customers. That's a huge responsibility. Dirty Dancing. That's the point, you idiot. When we started Dirty Dancing and Jennifer Grey was brought up to star, I, 30 seconds into the movie business at that point, suggested maybe we needed someone more famous, more glamorous. She was a wonderful actress, but an everywoman, I said. "That's the point, you idiot," said the movie's real godfather and my current business partner, Jimmy Einer. "Every woman in the world will identify with her and think they too will get a good-looking bad boy to become a good boy for them. That is your audience." He was right, of course. Kano and the Kid. Here's another example. In Terminator 2, Arnold Schwarzenegger's character, the Terminator, gets half of the skin on his face blown off, revealing his metal exoskeleton beneath. In Mortal Kombat lives a character called Kano, who also has part of his face missing, revealing a metal plate with an LED kind of eye. They looked a bit similar to me, and since I made both movies relatively close to each other, I decided I would redesign Kano as we migrated the characters from the game to the first live-action Mortal Kombat movie. Close to that time, as a favor to someone, we had a class of kids from a junior high school in to see how we build sets and design movies. I was showing them around. Fight rehearsal. They loved it. Goro, the 8-foot-tall animatronic creature, they loved it. Wild statues and weapons from the parallel realm of Outworld, they loved it. Character designs for the movie, they loved. Wait, hold on. When we came to the designs for Kano, one boy started breathing heavily. "Is that Kano?" he asked nervously. "Yep," I said proudly. "But Kano has a metallic eye," he said, now out of breath. I started to worry about the kid. Maybe he was sick. I explained I didn't want Kano to look in Mortal Kombat anything like Arnold in Terminator 2, and he interrupted. He began to hyperventilate. "Kano has a metallic eye patch. You can't change that." "But Kano has a metallic eye patch." He was sweating, breathing quick and shallow. He was in the throes of a full-blown panic attack, all because I was going to change Kano's metallic eye. My mistake hit me. My audience point blank told me what to do. Okay, I said. "You're right. Kano does have a metallic eye patch. We'll change it back." I ripped the design off the board and tore it up. Immediately, he started to calm down. He made me promise again, and then he was fine. What I realized so suddenly was that I wanted to change Kano because I wanted to do something a bit different so I didn't repeat myself, and so I would be creatively challenged every second. But see what's wrong with the previous sentence? It's all I and not my audience. The audience, embodied by that poor kid, couldn't care less about what I wanted, and nor should they care. They wanted their beloved character to look in the movies as he does in the game. We changed Kano back that day, and he remains a popular character in the movies and games 25 years later. Mad Scientist in Japan. We financed at Vestron a campy horror comedy called Reanimator, based on an H.P. Lovecraft novel. It parodied 50s horror movies. The movie featured a mad scientist trying to reanimate, or bring back from the dead, people. It was wild, crazy, over the top, full of gratuitous violence and goofy sex. People loved it, and it became a huge hit. The scene everyone talked about most was this. Towards the end, the mad scientist has the damsel in distress, wearing very little, strapped down to an operating table in his mad scientist lab. Oh, and his head has been cut off, so he carries it around, gripped by the hair in his right hand. Naturally. At one point, the headless scientist stands next to the damsel and, holding his head, kisses her in the cheek, then neck, then his hand and the head goes down out of frame and, well, you get the picture. It became known, and forgive this if you're a prudish, as the head-giving head scene. Again, talked about in the U.S. and Europe, but nothing more. In Japan, a different story. Our chief of the Japanese office had other plans. He put the head-giving head scene on the video box. He made posters he sent to every video store in the country. Remember, you couldn't actually see any nudity or anything. It was all implied and more ridiculous than sexy. And he took out ads and billboards. The head-giving head scene became a phenomenon in Japan, and the video became one of the biggest in Japanese history. Why? Because our chief of Japan knew his audience. The Japanese read wild manga and watch over-the-top crazy anime. Our chief embraced this and was not afraid, nor should he have been. He came to New York proudly to celebrate with us and give everyone their own head-giving head posters. Know your audience and act boldly on that knowledge. I have a little speech before we start every movie. You don't work for me, the director, or the studio, I say. You work for the audience, your customers. You have to know them, not just impersonal demographic info, but what they really want. Ideas drive tech. Let your idea drive your technology, not the other way around. See the Eiffel Tower in your mind, then figure out how to build it, versus seeing lots of metal joints and figuring out an idea for them. This is where things like the metaverse come into play. The metaverse, for example, doesn't really exist yet commercially as I read this. The question is, should it exist commercially for you? Only if you have a great idea that the metaverse will help you bring to your audience. Star Trek versus the studio. We also produce theme park rides. A while ago, we wanted to make one where the audience, seeing in stereoscopic 3D, could walk through a Star Trek Borg cube floating in space. If you're not up on Star Trek, the Borg are chief bad guys. The problem, at that point, there were no cameras that could move and shoot 3D at the same time. 3D was all stationary. But so what? It would make for a great experience. We pitched it, sold it, and then, with another company, set out to invent a 3D moving camera called a Steadicam. We succeeded, which helped drive the craze of 3D movies. Then one of the studios came to us saying they were going to start a 3D TV network and could we provide content? Sure, we said. What kind of content do you want? We don't know. Okay, who's your audience? We asked. We don't know. Finally, we asked, why are you doing this? They answered, because everyone else is. It's the hot tech thing. Their network lasted maybe 6 months. Ideas rule. Technology helps them come alive. Chasing the new hot thing will get you nowhere. Creating a new idea and then using whatever means you need to make it work will succeed. Hold on to your idea. Never let it go. Once you have gone through these first three steps and now you have your great idea, there's one more step. Hold on for dear life. Never give up. Everyone, like the current of that river I mentioned, will try to dissuade you. Do not let them. Be bold and big if you like, but once you lock on, never lose focus. Just do not give up on it. This is really the most important step because talent, a great idea, is only half the battle. This is the other half. You gotta see these. At that same first job, Vestron, where we made Platoon, one of the filmmakers we backed, let's call him Ernest, had the greatest ideas for horror movies. We'd often greenlight low-budget movies in those days just based on the concept or the poster, so to speak. The only problem with Ernest is that he would always go over budget and then rob Peter to pay Paul. In other words, he would use down payments on movies number 2, number 3, and number 4 to finish his over-budget movie number 1. Or maybe he was stealing the money. We didn't really care too much in a sense because all those movies were wildly profitable even with the constant over-budgets. But at a point, things got worse, kind of unignorable. My boss, Austin, and I confronted him in a suite in Cannes at the Film Market. Austin, a great guy, but one who could be really intimidating when he wanted, paced up and down, yelling at Ernest, "How could you do this to us? We trusted you. We believed in you." Ernest just sat there, implacable, legs crossed, one arm draped over the back of the couch, almost smiling. Austin turned things up a notch. "We financed you, turned you into a mini studio, and this is how you repay us?" No response, calm as can be. "We have a lien on your business, your house. We can take everything and bankrupt you." This went on for 20 minutes. Austin finally asked, "What have you got to say for yourself?" Ernest smiled and said, "Austin, Larry, I completely understand where you're coming from. But before I address that, please let me show you something." And he lifted the arm draped over the couch to reveal he was holding 3 movie posters for new movies. "I wanted to show you these concepts for 3 new films." In the face of losing everything he had, his entire plan was 3 new ideas. That was it. You got to see these concepts. You know what? They were great. So you know what we did? We bought all 3 movies. Even though he had either stolen or been wildly irresponsible with our money, the ideas were so good, we went for it. And they all wound up making money. He had such faith in his ideas that even though we could have taken his house, he was unwavering, focused, determined, and would do anything to get these movies made. He truly believed in them. By the way, our focus, our great idea, was to find these filmmakers with a touch of the madness and take chances to keep our supply of films robust and innovative. And it worked. Time of my life almost wasn't. Here's another example. Dirty Dancing was a script in turnaround, meaning another studio had developed it, but then deeming it no good, put it on the shelf. We bought it from them. No one wanted to make it. And it was in trouble. Long story how, but our company managed to lure a music and producing legend who lived nearby named Jimmy Einer to come oversee it. Jimmy then brought in a music supervisor named Michael Lloyd. The song Time of My Life was originally done as a high falsetto. No good, Jimmy and Michael knew. They tried and tried to get someone to sing it low and deep, but no one wanted to. They finally convinced Bill Medley of the Righteous Brothers to do it, I think as a favor. He recorded it in one afternoon. Now we had our low and deep version. But his manager didn't like it, demanded all kinds of changes. No one else liked it either. Everyone, the record company, our director, wanted changes. Jimmy and Michael said, "Sure, we'll change it." 2 weeks later, they sent in the song with a new date on it and a new note saying, here's the latest version. And we sent it to radio stations who like it. Hope you like it as well. Everyone, the manager, the director, all loved the new changes. The changes were brilliant, they said. Just the thing. But you know what Jimmy and Michael really changed? Nothing. Not a note. They just put a new date on the label. That's all they changed. The date. Jimmy and Michael knew what they had. They believed in their idea. In the face of constant criticism, they sent it to even more people, the radio stations. They doubled down and went bigger. And the song is one of the most successful in history. It won the Academy Award and the Grammy that year for Best Song. Jimmy is my partner in my company to this day, and Michael is still our music supervisor and great friend. First they greet you, then they eat you. When making low-budget horror movies at Vestron, I would often greenlight them, as I said, just by the poster, the concept. But what if the poster is fantastic, but the movie, not so much? That's the decision facing me in a movie called, no kidding, Blood Diner. The creator and director, Jackie Kong, I really liked. She was a whirlwind force of nature. Talk about a touch of the madness. I mean that, of course, as a compliment. She certainly swam away from the current of the river of life and avoided the middle. The concept was fun, and Jackie was the kind of extreme talent I liked to back, but I didn't think the script was good enough. Even so, we ordered the poster concepts. I still remember seeing the poster for the first time. It featured a beautiful, almost Art Deco shot of an old American diner at night with the tagline, "First they greet you, then they eat you." I just loved it. I knew that alone would sell a million videocassettes. But could I greenlight this? It was way, way out there. I thought this poster and tagline were so good, I had a feeling I would somehow, years from them, be glad I did. So I greenlit the movie. It was, well, out there. Bizarre. I didn't really understand the film, as I didn't comprehend the script, but it did sell a gazillion cassettes, and then I lost track of it. A few years ago, I started getting calls to do interviews for Blood Diner. I thought someone was punking me. Then, I got invited to come to its weekend showing at Quentin Tarantino's theater in L.A. No way, I thought. This film is still showing in theaters? Decades later? I cajoled two of my wildest, up-for-anything DJ sister friends to come with me. I wore a baseball cap, high collar, like a cartoon character trying not to be recognized. The midnight show was sold out. So crowded, I couldn't even find seats with my friends. Now, I can't say even all these years later, I really understand the appeal. But as I said in this book, who cares what I think? The audience absolutely loved it. I learned Blood Diner has become a cult classic. My feeling years ago that in the future I would be glad I greenlit the movie came true. All because of a great poster and tagline. That simple idea became responsible for a movie that has been playing for over 30 years. Okay, so first, create your ideas. But then, let them be your North Star. Believe in them. Chapter 3. Ask. Now you have created your great idea and your unwavering faith in it. What's next? Second way to cultivate a touch of the madness? Ask. Ask for what you want. Ask anybody for anything you want, anywhere. The easiest way to get anything you want is to ask. Call anybody, ask for anything in pursuit of your goals. No such thing as being shy. No is just the beginning. Ask, ask, ask. If you could call anyone in the world and ask them one question, who would you call and what would you ask? Right now, answer. Most people can't. Don't feel bad. They don't know. That's because they don't assume they could call anyone in the world. Well, you can. Here are some examples. Guns N' Roses, "You Could Be Mine If You Will Just..." When we were making Terminator 2, it was at the time the most expensive movie ever produced. Of course, we wanted to make sure every base, every promotional opportunity was covered. In those days, MTV played music videos and was a huge phenomenon. A video on MTV, if a hit, could be played like 15 times a day for free. So I wanted to do a music video for T2. First, I asked the studio. They said no. Remember, no is just the beginning. I asked the director. He was all for it as long as it was natural to the movie. I asked Arnold, who was not contractually obligated to do this. He said, sure, if you get the biggest band in the world. I said, no prob. Who do you think that is? He called his brother-in-law, who was in the music business, listened, then turned to me and said, Guns N' Roses. I said, sure. I didn't know anyone involved with Guns N' Roses. I called Geffen Records, the band's management, and their A&R team. The band was about to put out a two-album set called Use Your Illusion, destined to be the biggest album of the year. We invited them to come see a private, rough-cut screening of the movie. The band liked it. They asked us which song we wanted to use. We picked one called You Could Be Mine. Axl Rose, the band's lead singer, told me it was exactly the one he would have chosen, so we were in sync. Honestly, a lucky break, but we did ask. Great song, but it wasn't going to be the first single released, the one that would get all the promotion. We needed it to be. In those days of albums, the record company would pick one song that they would release to radio stations to promote the album, and then if the audience wanted to buy that song, they had to buy the whole album. We asked Arnold and his then-wife Maria if they would host a dinner party for Guns N' Roses. Gracious as can be, they did. I pitched the band the idea of switching singles, changing the whole release pattern of the album. They didn't say yes or no, but they seemed to like the dinner conversation and the plan, especially Slash, their lead guitarist. The next day, I went to present that to Geffen Records. It was like 20 of them and me. You have to understand, this was the absolute biggest, hottest band in the world, poised to release the biggest album of the year, and I was asking them to switch singles, which means change their entire marketing strategy. Now, their being associated with T2 could be great for them, but T2 hadn't come out yet, so it was a gamble. One of their executives really let me have it. You movie guys think you can just waltz in here and get us to change our strategy for our carefully crafted release of the biggest band in the world, and we'll just do it. Let me tell you something. Then Slash walked in. He saw me, smiled, and pointed to me. He said, "Hey, the movie guy, let's do what he wants." They all jumped up and said, "Yes, of course, Slash. Wonderful idea, Slash. We were just about to do that, Slash. Let's do it." Now we had the director, star, band, and record company all on board. You know what we didn't have? The money. Remember, the studio at first said no. I did all this without having the money. But with everyone on board and our song being the new single, I gambled they couldn't really say no anymore. I asked again, and they said yes. No is only the beginning. But it wasn't over because we actually had to make the video. In the concept of the video, the Terminator is hunting Guns N' Roses to kill them. But when he sees Axl Rose, the band's lead, his Terminator vision says, "Waste of ammo," and they nod to each other and he lets them go. We used footage from the movie cut with new footage we shot for the video. A big part of that is the band playing a concert at what's supposed to be an LA landmark venue of rock and roll called the Roxy. But as opposed to recreating the Roxy somewhere private, in other words, a set, the band would, for authenticity's sake, only shoot the exteriors at the real Roxy. The problem is the real Roxy is on Sunset Boulevard, the main street in the middle of Hollywood. It meant, of course, as soon as we put up a sign on Sunset Boulevard on the Roxy marquee, which we needed for the shot in the video, saying, "Tonight only, Guns N' Roses in concert," the world would think it was true and start a mini riot. I had to ask everyone, studio, police, Arnold, if we could do that. They agreed, and it did sort of start a mini riot, a friendly one, but huge. There were dozens of police cars. The band, as I recall, was a bit late because even they couldn't get through the crowd. Arnold waited for them with his usual class and aplomb. It goes on and on. At the end of the day, the song went platinum, the video did play 15 times a day on MTV, and it won a Video of the Year fan contest on MTV. Why? Because I never stopped asking. True Lies, True Request. The story of the movie True Lies is based on a French film called La Totale. Everything came together. Arnold wanted to star, Jim Cameron was going to direct it, and the money would be there. But the only thing we didn't have were the rights. The rights to remake La Totale were held by a producer who was much older and more accomplished than me at the time. Nevertheless, I called him and said, "We want to use this story as a vehicle for all these wonderful people who would be really grateful if you just give us the rights. So will you?" Crazy, right? But he did, and we made the movie. Ask. Bobblehead Cher. Not too long ago, we had Cher in an animated movie, using her voice, but also her likeness, playing Bobblehead Cher. When doing press for the movie, Cher was asked by People magazine, "You've never done an animated movie before. Why did you pick this one?" Cher's answer, "No one ever asked me before. I asked her." If Cher, one of the most famous and iconic people in the world, never was asked to be in an animated movie, Can you imagine who else is out there waiting for you to call and ask them?
Sample complete. Ready to continue?